Good morning, everyone. I'm Diane Sykes from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. I'd like to welcome you all this morning to the first of several showcase panels at this year's National Lawyers Convention. Our topic this morning is judicial selection, federal and state. We have been debating the issue of judicial selection for more than 200 years, and I would like to begin this morning with a story from the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, where there was a debate over the establishment of the inferior federal courts, including the subject of who should appoint the judges of the lower federal courts, Congress or the President. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued in favor of presidential appointment, as with the Supreme Court, in order to avoid the intrigue, partiality, and concealment that would attend appointment by the legislative body. John Rutledge of South Carolina strongly disagreed. He argued that the people will think we are leaning too much toward monarchy. Catherine Drinker Bowen, in her classic Miracle at Philadelphia, describes how this impasse was broken. Here's what she wrote. As the debate mounted, Dr. Franklin interposed mildly. Only two modes of choosing the judges, he said, had so far been mentioned. It was a point of great moment, and he wished other modes might be suggested. He would like to mention one which he understood was practiced in Scotland. He then, according to an account contained in James Madison's notes, in a brief and entertaining manner related a Scotch mode in which the nomination proceeded from the lawyers, who always selected the ablest of the profession in order to get rid of him and share his practice among themselves. Here in America, on the other hand, it was the interest of the electors to make the best choice. The author continues, when this particular old man told a story, it was impossible not to be diverted. Madison moved that in the ninth resolve the words appointment by the legislature be struck out and a blank left to be hereafter filled on maturer reflection. In the committee of the whole, the states voted, approving 9-2. We are very privileged this morning to be joined by four distinguished panelists, each of whom has given a great deal of mature reflection to the issue and problems of judicial selection. Professor William Kelly, on my right, teaches constitutional law and administrative law at the Notre Dame Law School, where he has taught since 1995. From 2005 to 2007, he served in the White House as deputy counsel to President Bush. In that capacity, he was responsible for, among other things, helping to coordinate the administration's judicial selection and confirmation process. He has also served as assistant to the Solicitor General at the United States Department of Justice, law clerk to the Honorable Kenneth Starr on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, as well as law clerk to Chief Justice Warren Burger and Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. He earned his bachelor's degree from Marquette University in my hometown of Milwaukee and his law degree from Harvard Law School. Professor Bill Marshall is currently the Kennan Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina. He has recently served as the Solicitor General of the State of Ohio. And during the Clinton administration, Professor Marshall served in the White House as Deputy Counsel and Deputy Assistant to the President. He received his law degree from the University of Chicago and his undergraduate degree from the University of Pennsylvania. On my left, Professor Meryl Chertoff is director of the Sandra Day O'Connor Project on the State of the Judiciary at Georgetown Law Center, director of the Georgetown Conversations, a law and public policy dinner symposium program, and adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University. She has also served as director of New Jersey's Washington, D.C. office under two governors, legislative counsel to the chairman of the New Jersey State Assembly and Appropriations Committee. Professor Chertoff is a graduate of Harvard Radcliffe College and earned her J.D. from Harvard Law School. The Honorable Harold C. Jr. was elected Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of Alabama in 1996. Justice C. served as Assistant Professor of Economics at Illinois State University, practiced law at Sidley and Austin, and was a professor at the University of Alabama School of Law, where he taught for over 20 years. Justice C. received his bachelor's degree from Emporia State University, a master's degree in economics from Iowa State University, and earned his law degree at the University of Iowa. Please join me in welcoming our panel. And Professor Kelly will begin.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure and indeed an honor to be here, and looking forward to not only this panel, but the program generally. Professor Marshall and I both had the privilege of serving as deputy counsel to different presidents, which is a laugh a minute when you're in that job. He noted when we came in that he's actually about 24 years old, and that I used to have a full head of brown hair. But I do think that experience does give us some insight into the federal judicial selection process, and the ironies abound in how the wheel turns, because we've gone now through multiple cycles of the tables being turned on the respective parties. And now it's the Republicans' turn to deal with judicial nominations by a Democratic president from a position of being in the minority in the Senate. A lot is obviously at stake in judicial nominations and confirmations, but probably less should be at stake than is. We've seen a remarkable transformation in just one generation in how the political culture views the federal courts. In the time of President Reagan, judicial nominations were relatively uncontroversial, with very few exceptions. Imagine today a Richard Posner or a Frank Easterbrook being confirmed with little to no controversy, or a Antonin Scalia or Robert Bork to the Court of Appeals. Even Ken Starr got confirmed easily. That was a private joke between me and my judge, who's sitting in the front row. But in the last 30 years, we've seen the people and the political branches, particularly in Congress, wake up to the significance of judges. And it's because, I believe, there's been a transformation in how we conceive of the role of judges. My own view is that that is a real threat to the very basis of our constitutional structure, which depends fundamentally on a distinction between law and politics. In his dissent in the Casey case, Justice Scalia said that judicial confirmations have become highly politicized, particularly at the Supreme Court level, because the American people aren't fools and they love democracy. So what do we do in this cycle of escalation, if from a Republican standpoint, when the purpose of picking judges seems more and more to be to get outcomes based upon the identity of the parties or the political impact of the case, rather than deciding contested cases and controversies according to the rule of law? My own view is that the Republicans ought not to further escalate. I think that the Republicans in the Congress, in the Senate, ought to act on the merits, which is to say, if a person is highly qualified and if a person convinces a senator that he or she will apply the law rather than whatever sense of empathy she has, then that person should be confirmed. It's a hard thing, though, because we certainly haven't seen that behavior, at least in the hard cases, over the last 8 years. And of course, the Democrats would say that that was responsive to the prior 8 years, and there's plenty of anecdotal information to support both sides. But I do think that the rule of law does depend upon judges being judges and not being outcome determiners in a way that depends on things other than the law. So what is the dynamic going to be? The most important fact of our current political situation is less that the president is a Democrat and much more that the Senate is so firmly in Democratic hands. One insight, or one thing I learned, I should say, in working in the White House, and as an egg-headed academic, I never really fully appreciated this before, is the huge importance, indeed dispositive importance, most of the time, of home state senators, and correlatively, the huge importance of having a majority in the Senate. People ask me, what's the secret of getting Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito confirmed? And the answer is clearly 55 votes in the Senate. So it's going to be very, very difficult for Republicans to stop President Obama's nominees from being confirmed, and I think relatively easily. Having said that, what the Republicans should do, I think, is exploit as much as they can the power of the minority short of filibustering. Make them take their time. Be deliberate. Put people through their motions. Do not just rubber stamp. I think it's destructive of the system, particularly of the federal courts, to have judges require 60 votes to be confirmed. So what does it mean to say that the most important thing is the number of votes that the incumbent president has in the Senate and his party? Well, obviously they control the agenda, and obviously they control outcomes all the time. Now, the Republicans over the last 8 years didn't always exploit that majority as well as they should have. I think it's a tragedy, for example, that Peter Keisler was not confirmed to the D.C. Circuit at a time when the Republicans had 55 votes in the Senate. And that was because Republicans held him up for reasons unrelated to the merits of the nomination. The best way for Republicans to get leverage in the process is not just by simply opposing the incumbent president. It is by exploiting the institutional interest of the Senate as a whole in contrast to the executive branch. The Senate has institutional interests which are very strong, and they have traditions which are very strong, and often senators will give credence and weight to the institutional interests of the Senate over their party's interests. And what I'm thinking of specifically is the prerogatives of home state senators. There is not a single sitting federal judge today nominated by President Bush who had a home state senator vote no. Carolyn Kuhl was nominated and brought to a vote over the objection of home state senators, but she did not succeed in getting confirmed. Senator Leahy, over the last 2 years, has fallen an unbroken practice of respecting the requirement of both home state senators returning blue slips. And as an institutional matter, the senators of both parties agree that the prerogatives of the home state senator over time are stronger than the prerogatives of the incumbent president of their own party. So for many years in the first term of President Bush, we had two Republican senators in Virginia and pending a circuit court nomination from Virginia. And the Republican senators acceded to the claim that moving the seat from Maryland to Virginia, as had been done, was institutionally more important to stop than to get the person confirmed. So exploiting the institutional interests of the Senate vis-a-vis the executive is the way to go. So I do think that the Republicans in states where they have seats need to be very aggressive, and I'm sure they will be, in asserting those home state prerogatives. That will certainly have a moderating influence on the nominees from those states. What to expect in substance from President Obama's nominees, I think, is obviously very difficult to know. I think there's going to be a tension. As Senator McConnell noted, a new president with the political capital that he has needs to make choices about how to govern. And I'm no political prognosticator, but there's going to be pressure on President Obama as a general matter not to govern from the left, at least at the outset. But it's not clear to me that that will hold for judicial nominations, because they receive less scrutiny from the media and the public. The public doesn't care about inferior court nominations. And they matter a lot to interest groups. So there's going to be, I think, a temptation in the administration to be more left-leaning when it comes to judicial nominations than as a general matter in how the president governs. What's more, President Obama obviously has the mindset, President-elect Obama, I shouldn't get ahead of myself, has the mindset of a law professor. He taught for many years at the University of Chicago. He's around a lot of law professors. Law professors advise him. And my experience, and it's a humble experience with the law professoriate, has been that law professors sometimes don't quite understand where baselines are to normal people. So what seems perfectly moderate and ordinary and acceptable to law professors strike ordinary folks often as kind of wacky. So I think there's some chance that there's going to be a baseline problem in how the administration approaches the views of nominees. Having said that, the president-elect is obviously very shrewd, very smart, very legally sophisticated, and obviously as well very self-interested. And insofar as his judicial nominations create political controversy and difficulties for him or threaten to create that, obviously he's going to try to avoid that. So he's going to be walking at a tense line in the choice of his inferior court nominees. I fear that the trend line will be more to the left than would be prudent, because of the structural influences on him and his own background and views. I will stop there. I promised to speak for 10 minutes. On the Supreme Court, I'll say one sentence, which is that the president-elect will be able to nominate and get confirmed whomever he pleases. That's what 58 or 9 or 60 votes in the Senate does for you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's always an honor for me to be asked to speak before the Federalist Society. I'm not exactly one of your charter members. But I do appreciate the debate and chance for debate that this organization has always given, not just at the national programs where I've been very honored to speak, but at the local law school ones as well. And I truly want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. That said, folks, welcome to the wilderness. I've been there for 8 years, and any of you who want survival tips at the end of the panel today, I'll be happy to counsel each of you individually. But the good news about democracy is that there's always an end in sight. If you listen to one side of the federal judicial selection process, you hear that the other side broke the rules. They're doing nothing but proposing ideologues who want to do nothing but move the court to accomplish certain political positions. If you hear the other side talk, the other side is breaking the rules, and the other side is doing nothing but trying to appoint judges to accomplish political positions. And the fact is both sides believe it. And they honestly believe it. I mean, I listened to Senator McConnell, a senator who I respect not just for his principal positions on campaign finance, which I think anybody has to take the First Amendment seriously, and I'm disappointed that a lot of folks on my side of the equation don't take it as seriously as they do. That doesn't mean that we should abandon efforts, but I think certainly a major issue. Senator McConnell also has the courage to take his commitment to the First Amendment to other areas that are not necessarily so easily partisan, like flag burning and opposing the flag burning amendment. But it's interesting to see his perspective because he's talking right past me. I understand the position he's taking, but it seems to me that if you look at it the other way, the rules have been broken in the other direction. Take the blue slip policy. The fact was that Senator Hatch, when he was the head of the Judiciary Committee under Clinton, took the blue slip policy quite seriously. When he was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee with President Bush, he didn't. And he pushed a number of senators who didn't have blue slips to hearings. That's one of the reasons that triggered the filibuster with respect to the Michigan senators and led to a further escalation, the abandonment of that particular rule. So recognizing these debates that there really is a serious point on the other side, and it gets even more difficult when we get to this question of what is following the rule of law. From my perspective, I read Attorney General Meese's papers that came out of the Reagan Justice Department talking about how you needed to appoint judges with particular philosophies in order to be able to accomplish certain constitutional change. That doesn't sound to me like the appointment of judges who are going to do nothing but apply the law in an even-handed fashion. It sounds to me like they're judges that might be picked with an ideological ambition in mind. And I think that triggers the response on the other side. And certainly things that are said on the Democratic side of the equation trigger similar responses on the Republican side. And it becomes even more difficult, I think, when you realize that a lot of what's going on is not conscious. Cass Sunstein wrote something after Bush versus Gore, and he noted that what was interesting about where the academics broke on that is that if you tended to support Gore, you thought it was a bad decision, and if you tended to support President Bush, you thought it was a good decision. And you came up with a legal analysis that somehow supported your conclusion. I'm not sure people were intentionally thinking backwards, as much as they were engaged in something called motivated reasoning. The number one person who recognized motivated reasoning, by the way, was none other than Justice Scalia in the White case, Minnesota Republican Party versus White, dealing with the question of what judges could say during campaigns. And it was Justice Scalia who wrote that you can't expect judges not to bring their personal philosophies to decision-making. So therefore, he argued, it was appropriate for judges in an election to be able to do more than just announce their credentials and talk a bit about the issues. So you have that working as well. What looks to a conservative like a neutral, fair opinion looks to a liberal like it's ideologically motivated. What looks to a liberal like it's an ideologically neutral opinion looks to a conservative like it's ideologically motivated. And the problem with that perception, and Bill is exactly right, the problem with the perception that has been created is that law is nothing but politics because we don't seem to reach out enough to be able to understand that an opinion that we seriously disagree with doesn't necessarily have to be ideologically motivated and can actually be what that judge believes is a fair interpretation of the law. We don't give each other the credit that I think we should. I come from a mixed family. My dad was a very conservative Republican. My mom was a liberal Democrat. Turns out my mother was smarter. But overall, at least I learned, and we haven't learned because we've become so politically divisive, in order to see the substance in the other side's position. I wrote an article a little while ago. It says that now, because we don't do that anymore, I wrote the article entitled Constitutional Law's Political Spoils. And it says it all. It says it indirectly in the federal judicial nomination process by the fact that picking a judiciary, whichever code words you want to use, that the candidates are bringing, you know it's code words. You certainly know that the other side recognizes as code words. You want a judiciary that's going to give you the political results that you want, and it becomes even more express when we're talking about the state elections process later. I think we all need to do what Bill talked about. We all need to get above the game a little bit. We need to talk more about qualifications more. We need to talk about other kinds of neutral criteria in order to be able to move the process along so it isn't so broken and so it doesn't have this constant escalation after another. Whether we're going to be able to do it or not, I don't know. There are a lot of vested interests in this town particularly in not having that happen on both sides of the equation. But I think it's going to have to be people like the people on this panel and others who talk about the necessity of trying to depoliticize the process somewhat if we're going to get the kind of judiciary that we aspire to. And the final point on this is what's really disturbing about a politicization of the judicial system is that it seems to me to license people to do what they otherwise might do. It's one thing to have a political view when you're coming into office. It's another thing to be told by the election process that it's okay to use that political view in your judicial opinions. And I'm afraid the over-politicization of the process is giving licenses in a way that it shouldn't. So maybe we can all unite together and try to present the point that I think Bill was very, very eloquently talking about in terms of what kind of qualifications we should look at. So thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here today for my maiden appearance at the Federalist Society. When my colleagues in the Judicial Independence corner of the think tank world make presentations about the problems of state court elections, they usually start with a few anecdotes about the latest outrageous state court judicial races throughout the country, the millions of dollars raised in the invective filled ads, and I'm going to do a little bit of that, but I want to do that in order to bring us back to the point, which is, what is the essence of conservatism when it comes to the selection of judges And while we've heard so far about federal judges, I'm going to confine my remarks to state court judges. In the 2008 election cycle, one of the most surprising judicial races took place in Michigan, where Democrat Diana Hathaway defeated Michigan's chief judge, Cliff Taylor, a Republican, who first won election in 2000 after being appointed by then-Governor John Engler to fill an unexpired term. While Taylor broke his own previous fundraising record by garnering $1.8 million, and the state Republican Party and Michigan Chamber of Commerce both ran ads portraying Hathaway as soft on terrorists and on sexual predators, an ad run by the state Democratic Party labeling Taylor the sleeping judge — they apparently caught Judge Taylor on tape during a notably boring moment in an oral argument — got some traction with voters, and Hathaway run in an upset. In Alabama, which recently elected Sue Bell Cobb, a Democrat chief judge, after another bitter race, the 2008 Supreme Court judicial races were again nasty and bitter. The candidates raised a total of $3.8 million, and the Virginia-based Center for Individual Freedom spent close to $1 million on an independent TV ad campaign. Both candidates ran ads attacking the other for the sources of their campaign contributions, and the campaign included attacks on the Alabama Bar Association and the ABA. Judicial elections are nothing new, but the amount of money spent on them and the nastiness of the campaigns are a relatively new phenomenon. Let's walk through how we got there. State court selection of their judges vary widely. 43 states have some form of judicial elections, and in some states these are partisan elections and some nonpartisan elections. Other states have adopted the so-called Missouri plan, which is something sometimes in a more loaded phrasing called merit selection. Under these arrangements, a panel of judicial candidates is submitted by a commission for review by the governor, who makes appointments for the preliminary term. Then, after a single term in office, the judge faces the voters, now with the advantage of incumbency and a track record. And finally, there are states like my own home state of New Jersey, where there are no elections and judges are selected solely by the governor, or states like Virginia, neighboring here, where judges are selected by the legislature. As Professor Charles Jay has observed, the struggle to balance independence and accountability has played itself out over the course of more than two centuries, and the balance has been struck by states in a variety of ways. The selection arrangements in any given state reflect the politics prevailing in the period when the state's constitution was established or in its most recent iteration. During the Jacksonian 1820s and 1830s, populist calls for judicial accountability initiated a movement to select judges by partisan judicial elections. Mississippi was the first state with partisan elections in 1832, and by 1901, 35 states either entered the Union with judges elected in partisan elections or had converted to partisan elections from appointive systems. In the early 20th century, the pendulum swung the other way, and progressive era views that elections led to selection of judges who were beholden to special interests and party bosses led to the development in Missouri of a signal reform, which was the Missouri Plan, in which the governor selected judges from a pool of candidates whose qualifications had been reviewed and approved by an independent commission. By 1989, 23 states had adopted the Missouri Plan. And as I said, in my own home state in New Jersey, in 1947, in their framing of their new constitution, the elite framers, who viewed the public as unreliable and unduly influenced by urban party bosses, decided upon a system which was a governor's selection of judges at every single level, from the courts of limited jurisdiction all the way up to the Supreme Court of New Jersey. For many years, judicial elections were sleepy affairs. Many judges were selected to fill unexpired terms, and generally those judges won handily in their next election. Small amounts of money were raised, and in a phenomenon known as roll-off, many voters never even reached the bottom of the ticket where the races for judge were to be found. So the numbers of people actually voting for judge were relatively small. Two things changed this. First, with the tort wars, which pitted trial lawyers against corporate interests. When one side or another found themselves on the losing side of the battle over tort reform in the state houses, they began to look to the courts, where large damage awards were often made in product and personal injury litigation, and began to see opportunities to influence the outcome of cases by getting elected to the bench judges with the, quote, right, unquote, judicial philosophy. The other was the rise of polling in judicial races, whereby interest groups sought to vet judges on key social issues by asking their replies to questions often bordering on how they might rule in particular cases. The state canons of judicial ethics were often used by judicial candidates as a haven against those polls, but the Supreme Court case of Republican Party of Minnesota against White eliminated that haven, meaning that judges cannot ethically be barred from responding to the polls. All this came against the background of campaign finance reform, which meant that large amounts of money could be raised and targeted at particular state court judicial races from sources around the country, not just within the state where the election was taking place. The result was an explosion in the expense, rhetoric, and nastiness of judicial races. Ad campaigns accused candidates of corruption or violation of their oaths, or of being soft on criminals or insufficiently protective of family values. And the problem is that unlike in a state legislative race, the judges themselves are very limited as to what they can say about their rulings in particular cases. The public generally doesn't understand very well that in about 99% of cases, judges are bound by precedent and generally don't have a great deal of discretion in their rulings. So these ads are a race to the bottom that do nothing to educate the public about the function of the judiciary and do everything to cause voters to question not only the integrity of particular judges, but to misunderstand the very nature of judging. They ask the public to select judges who will rule our way rather than rule according to the facts and the law. So in effect, they reduce judicial elections to a referendum on who represents the public's prevailing view best. I thought that was the role of legislative elections personally. And if we want to have three separate branches, the judge needs to be able to exercise his view of the law without fear that he'll lose office for doing so. Now, here's where I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of self-reflection. For a number of years, the Federalist Society was agnostic on the question of whether state judges should be elected or appointed. I myself was an agnostic on that question. After all, I come from a state where every judge is appointed, and as the old saying goes about making law and sausages, you might not always want to look too closely at how the list of the governors for the governor's review is put together in my home state. Here I concede that I differ from my mentor, Sandra Day O'Connor, who I work for at the Sandra Day O'Connor Project on Judicial Independence at Georgetown Law. Justice O'Connor has been pretty outspoken that she favors the Missouri plan, or the merit selection plan, a version of which she piloted through the Arizona legislature when she was a state legislator there, and which has worked to produce a high-quality state bench in Arizona. She also acknowledges that changing selection methods in the states is a tough go, and she's proposed through our project some more readily achievable changes, such as moving from partisan to nonpartisan elections and the increased use of recusal in cases where judges have received large campaign contributions from party or litigants. But her chief concern is keeping the state court judges independent of outside influences when they rule in cases. Until very recently, though, my own personal view was that if the temperature came down in some of these state court elections, putting the judges to a vote was no worse or better than any other way of selecting them. But over the past months, I have had some experiences in my work at the O'Connor Project that have caused me to realize that state court judicial races are not going to get any better anytime soon. We've tried to get some of the stakeholders on both sides of the issue to sit down to discuss what might be done to curb some of the excesses in these state court judicial campaigns. And they won't sit down to meet. They won't meet with Justice O'Connor, and they won't meet with our staff at the project. They won't meet because they think that they are winning, and as long as they are winning, they are not concerned about the integrity of the process. And here's where I need to ask you to consider the perils of populism. My friends here at the Federalist Society are, I think, still largely agnostic on the issue of election versus selection of judges. But among the membership, I think there is a perception that merit selection is a bad idea because there are too many lawyers doing the selection for the candidate pool, that the process is dominated by the bar associations, and the bar associations are dominated by plaintiff's trial lawyers. In other words, the process is skewed so that we won't get enough of our judges. That's the view of some in Missouri, where there have been some efforts in the state that originated it to revise the merit selection system there. They would rather go the populist route, that is, throw it open to the voters, because they think if we throw enough money at the races, the voters will vote our way. Well, I'll let you in on a secret, which the other speakers have noted also. It's a secret no more after November 4th, and that is that both sides can play this same game. While the people who are engaged in this arms race think that if they throw enough money in the game, they'll take the spoils, they run into two problems. First, they just might lose. Second, in the process of playing, they erode respect for the judges and for the institution of the courts. So if you think that the merit selection system doesn't work well because there are too many lawyers in it, I have a suggestion. There's a simple enough way to fix it. Lobby your state legislature or go for a state constitutional amendment. It's not as hard to get an amendment in the states as it is in the federal government, to adopt the merit selection of judges system and frame the commission provisions so that the public is well represented. Maybe there don't need to be any lawyers on these commissions. But if the process is transparent and there's good representation in those who vet the judges, you're going to get an acceptable pool of candidates. The point is that populism is only a good play if you think that it's going to work for you. Certainly it's a good play when you pick your legislator and even when you pick your president. But when in an era when conservatives may need some protection against the excesses of the other two branches, it is impartiality and faithful adherence to the law that win the day, and for that, you need independent judges. The Supreme Court has just granted certiorari in the case of Caperton against Massey Cole. For those of you who may not have followed it, that's the case where the Justice of the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia refused to recuse himself from the appeal of a $50 million jewelry verdict, even though the CEO of the lead defendant spent $3 million supporting his campaign for a seat on the court, more than 60% of the total amount spent to support the justice's campaign. While that CEO was preparing to appeal the verdict against his company, after winning election to the court, the justice cast the deciding vote in the court's 3-2 decision overturning that verdict. The case is an illustration of the worst excesses that result when too much money goes into state court races. In the words of my good friend Ted Olson, counsel for the petitioners who challenged the non-recusal, and I quote, "The improper appearance created by money in judicial elections is one of the most important issues facing our judicial system today. A line needs to be drawn somewhere to prevent a judge from hearing cases involving a person who has made massive campaign contributions to benefit him. We certainly believe in this case the judge crossed the line." I think that Ted and I may disagree as to whether Caperton counsels against electing judges in the state courts in the first place. I know that we do agree that these massive amounts of money are damaging the system and the judges need to remain independent. While I'd like to think that this can still happen in a system where judges are elected in the states, the unwillingness of the stakeholders here even to engage in dialogue with one another is very, very discouraging, and suggest that it may be time to engage in political reform that takes some of the populism out of the selection process.
Well, thank you. I would ask you also to think about these alternatives, to think about merit selection as opposed to election or appointment. What I heard was a presentation like very well done, but very much like I ordinarily hear, which is elections are nasty, they're expensive, they're mean, therefore, we should have merit selection. I'm reminded of a cartoon I saw one time. The scientist, he's writing on the blackboard, and he's got all these equations going down. And if you look right in the middle of the blackboard, it says, "And then a miracle happens." And I'm not sure what the miracle is that somehow, if it's worth millions of dollars to get a judge elected, it's somehow not worth millions of dollars to get him recommended from a commission. If the money is there, as Professor Chertoff suggests, because of these large amount of monies in tort cases and so on, that money's there. If we're talking about commissions and the benefits that commissions have, so we'll keep the lawyers off the commission. Well, some of these folks around here from Washington, D.C., commissions, of course, aren't influenced by the people who have financial interest in them, right? So we may remove it, but what we've done is we've hidden it. Let me just speak sort of generally about this topic. Popular self-government is messy. It's noisy, expensive, and it's mean. Politically accountable appointments in the federal government have been contentious and mean-spirited, petty, expensive. The Roberts and Alito nominations, were millions of dollars were spent on television advertising in that appointment process. State elections in some races in some states also have been contentious and mean and relatively expensive. I understand the impression is that happens in every race. Of course, we know that's not true, but it has happened more recently. And, of course, that's true of all politically accountable appointments and elections. The recent federal elections went on too long, were mean-spirited, were extraordinarily expensive, and I don't like many of the outcomes. Yet, I see no effort, no move to replace Congress with a commission of lawyers and others, or to put President-elect Obama's appointments into some sort of a commission for preclearance. The argument is, well, judges are different. That people don't understand the judicial role. I think it's true, judges are different. I think school board members are different. I think representatives to the legislature are different. I think there's a difference between electing someone as attorney general and electing someone as school board superintendent. I think we trust the people to understand that they should put the person in who's appropriate for the job. And if we're saying the public is too ignorant to understand the difference between a school board superintendent and an attorney general or a governor, then we've got a much bigger problem than the selection of judges. We have a problem with popular government, that it is hopeless, you know, that it can't be done. If people really are ignorant as to what role judges should play, then shouldn't our bar associations be investing in educating the public about the role of judges instead of trying to remove their franchise for the selection of judges? Popular selection is messy, noisy, sometimes mean. Winston Churchill observed that democracy is the worst possible form of government, except for every other one that has been tried. So I guess the question that we really need to ask is, well, what's going on? Elections are a problem. There are problems with elections. There are problems with appointment. I ask you, look into merit selection and see whether it solves those problems. Two of the nastiest races I hear about all the time are Rose Byrd in California and Penny White in Tennessee, both of which were merit selection, retention elections. This is another amazing thing, that we've got a problem with appointment. We've got a problem with election. So the answer is we'll do both. My problem is with the removal of it into some sort of a commission that is not politically responsible, and I'll tell you my next point is to tell you why. What we're talking about here, I believe, is a constitutional question. There are two philosophies that we see out there. I mean, we can divide it different ways, but we usually talk about it this way, about what a judge ought to be doing. There are those people, and I think I can state it most fairly by saying those people who say judges ought to do what's right. Or, you know, the word we heard earlier was they ought to empathize. My mouth's a little dry. The judges ought to do what is right regardless of what the law says, as opposed to judges ought to do what the law requires. I think that's a constitutional question. Now, I look at the Constitution and I see the way it's divided, and it says these are the powers for Congress, these are the powers for the executive, these are the powers for the judiciary, and I understand in that judges aren't supposed to be doing legislators' jobs. I mean, there's some checks and balances there, but basically, you know, we're supposed to be doing those separate jobs. That says to me that the legislature writes the law, and the judge tries to apply that law, to enforce that law as after the executive has implemented it. If instead we have a view that judges should change the law if the legislature hasn't done the right job of it, that is, that the law and the Constitution mean not what the Constitution says or not what the statute says, but what the judge says it says, that's a constitutional decision. That's a decision that says that judges play a different role. It's my view that that's a job, the decision as to what that Constitution means, is a job properly left to the public. Not to us as lawyers, for two reasons. One is we have an interest. Right? I mean, we'd much rather deal with the court than the legislature. We know how those folks operate in a court. So we have a bias in favor of the law means what the judge says it means. But there's a second problem. And that is, that's a decision that is made at the time the judge is put on the bench, not a decision made by the judge. In, I'm trying to remember, 1830s, I think it was, and you may have heard the story, Davy Crockett, you know, the coonskin cap guy, he was a politician. He ran for Congress, he won, he was elected, came to Washington, D.C., it was a new town. There were some houses that had been built, you know, trying to get the city going. And there was a fire that swept through those houses, a number of houses. Well, Congress considered it and thought, you know, we need to help out here. Bailout, I guess. And so Congress appropriated some money to help them rebuild their houses. When it came time for re-election, Davy Crockett was there in East Tennessee in his district. I don't know exactly how it happened. He went up to a yeoman farmer there. I'm guessing he probably put his foot up on the split rail fence or maybe walked into the field. He probably stuck his hand out and said, "Hello, I'm Davy Crockett. I'm your congressman. I'm running for re-election. I appreciate your vote." I don't know exactly how all that happened, but what is reported is that the farmer said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Crockett, I can't vote for you." And Davy Crockett said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, you remember they had that fire, and you appropriated that money to rebuild those houses." He says, "I don't believe that that's a proper function of the federal government, and so I'm going to have to vote against you." Now, you can agree or disagree with this voter, but the point is he was holding his representative accountable to the Constitution. He was making a constitutional decision about what it is proper for a legislator to do. I believe it is equally proper for the voter to hold a judge accountable for what the Constitution requires a judge to do. My chief problem with merit selection is it removes that accountability. It hides it. You don't know who's accountable. You can't go after the governor because he didn't have a choice. He got three names given to him by some folks that were picked who knows how. So you can't hold him accountable. The voters can't hold the judge accountable directly. I think that's a very serious problem. Thank you.
All right, I think we've teed the issues up very ably, and we'd like to begin a dialogue between the panelists now. Just to sort of kick that off, what I seem to be hearing from the panelists is that there are three votes for attempting to depoliticize or at least ratchet down the politics of judicial selection, whether election or appointment. And one vote, that would be our last panelist, Justice C., who says that can't be done. Because
I'm happy if you can ratchet down the politics, we won't have this problem. But you ratchet down the politics, then I'll change my position.
Well, whether it's an appointment or elective process, whether the people are choosing judges directly through the ballot box or indirectly by gubernatorial or presidential appointment, Senate confirmation, retention election features in the system, that it's inherently a political process, and that the judge wars that we're currently experiencing and have been for many years are essentially a byproduct of the philosophical struggle that's going on over the role of the judiciary in both our state systems and in our federal systems. So with that summary of what I think we just heard, Professor Kelly, do you have a response?
Just a couple of points. I listened to Bill Marshall talk, and what I heard, what I think many people in the room heard, and I have to confess a little bit of what I heard, and I regret to say this because I know he's a person of goodwill and good faith, et cetera, is, isn't it awfully convenient that it's now time to stand down when the shoe's on the other foot? And that's the problem. We have a vicious circle, and it's very hard to see people acting in a non-self-interested way here. One thing that happened in 2001 that has been little noticed and certainly not rewarded was that the president made a gesture, a very important gesture, in his very first judicial nominations to try to acknowledge what had happened during the Clinton years. And two of his 10 first Court of Appeals nominees were nominees of President Clinton who didn't get confirmed. Indeed, one of them was a judge who had been recess appointed after the president's party, President Clinton's party, had lost the election. And that was not, that gesture, which was significant, was not rewarded with goodwill and was not rewarded in kind. So I do think that we have a problem about how to get to a point of depoliticization at the federal level that doesn't require one party just to stand down and surrender. And that is obviously the dilemma. On the question of commissions and elections and the like, we do have experience at the federal level, it just so happens, in states where the senators are both from the party of opposite of the president during this administration, with something like commissions. And it's tended to work pretty well. One problem I see with commissions is it tends to produce judges who are I hate to insult any judges, but they're boring, right? They're in the middle. Yeah. Well, it was an extraordinary thing, actually, that Judge Sykes in Wisconsin, they had a commission. It was bipartisan, and it was at the insistence of the senators. And it was an extraordinary thing for a court of appeals seat to be committed to a commission by this president. It just so happens that that commission didn't have any choice but to include her on the list because the excellence was so apparent. I'm not actually just sucking up. It was actually true, okay? Because she, at the time, was a very prominent person in the state and the like. And for district court seats, the people aren't that prominent very frequently, and they tend to produce folks who are really kind of in the middle, not in any way. Many of them, all of them, I'm going to assume, if they're appointed by this president, are excellent judges, of course. But they're not crackling. It's designed not to produce the crackly nominee. Having said that, it's worked because we've had judges appointed who are good judges applying the law in states with two Democratic senators. I think of California, where we've had a bipartisan commission that generally worked for many years. Unfortunately, it broke down at the very end, and it's quite regrettable, actually, that Congressman Judge and former Congressman Jim Rogan made it through the bipartisan commission, and the senators wouldn't let him go forward. That's regrettable. But generally speaking, these have worked at the federal level. Now, I have no idea what the applicability of that at the state level is, but I'd throw it out there.
Professor Marshall.
I'm not sure if I'll ever prove to you all that I'm a person of goodwill, but I did write these articles about toning down the rhetoric during the Bush administration while that was going on, so I'm in print prior to today in terms of what I was talking about. Couple of things. Yes, President Bush did nominate a couple of folks who were Clinton holdovers. One of them had the support of both senators from Virginia, was the first African-American appointee to the Fourth Circuit. That's the resource appointee. But what President Bush didn't do, and again, we could go back and forth all day on this, but what President Bush didn't do is consult with the Senate Judiciary Committee in the same way that President Clinton consulted with the opposing party. President Bush never reached out to the Democrats on ideas for judicial selection. President Clinton did.
a lot of different reasons why I think that may have occurred, but that happened. With respect to elections, judicial elections, one of the first campaigns I was ever completely involved with was somebody running for the Court of Appeals in Ohio. He was immensely respected, taught at Harvard, a Republican. He ran against somebody who had the same name as the county prosecutor. Guess who won? Ask yourself when you vote the next time, if any of you vote in any judicial election, if you know who most of the people are who you're voting for. I ask my law school classes all the time, do you have any idea who it is that you're voting for when you vote for a judge? And the answer is, well, I don't have to give you the answer. You all know what the answer is. And I think one of the things that you get is you don't get the quality of – I don't know why anybody would run for judge in a state election when you have to raise that much money. You aren't getting that much pay. And then you know that you have to stand for election again. We're discouraging good people from getting involved. Yes, the process isn't perfect. Yes, you need accountability at some level or another. But ask yourself what you're doing when you're having people when you're electing people who most people, including lawyers, do not know who they are. Am I optimistic, by the way, that the tenor is going to change? No. Too many people feel that they have too much at stake. We are a divided country on ideological grounds. The hot button issues tend to divide us a lot more than I think they should. But I do think, and this is where I think probably everybody in this room agrees, that if we don't depoliticize the process, it's going to cause a serious erosion of what it means to adhere to the rule of law. And one final point, by the way, I don't know any Democrats or any liberals out there who say, throw the law away and just come to a result. I don't know where that comes from. I've heard it said a number of times today. We don't do that. I don't do that. I actually think the 11th Amendment decisions are correct, and I've written on that. I think Heller, at least in result, is correct. Give us a break. Adirond is one of the most activist, unprincipled decisions of all time. There is no original argument in the world that federal affirmative action is unconstitutional. Just depends on who you're looking at and how you view these particular decisions.
Professor Chertoff.
As I listened to Judge C talk about how the judges should be held to account by the people, I guess the question that occurs to me is the obvious contrast with the federal system. I think that we all pretty much agree that the framers were wise in the way that they set out the three-part system, and the people don't directly elect the judges in the federal system. Now, I recognize the fact, and my field of scholarship is state government, that at the state level we have a closer relationship and we want a little bit more accountability. But that accountability is built into the state system simply because the selectors and the electors, whoever they are closer to the system. The governors, there's more of a direct feedback loop to the governors. And there's more of a direct feedback loop with respect to these commissions. There's no reason that the commissions can't be set up in a way where their composition is completely transparent. And to the extent that the question is there any accountability, retention elections do provide that accountability. In fact, you could argue that that retention elections provide too much accountability because they don't solve the problem of judges being held to account and at least in their first term when they're submitted to the retention election, having to frame their decisions in such a way to assure that when they do come before the voters the first time, they will be deemed to be acceptable. So even to that extent, there are breaks on accountability breaks on the independence of those judges. Now, those may indeed at the state court level be appropriate breaks, but they are breaks on the system. To the extent that the argument is made that, you know, the judges, these state court judges will run rampant if they're selected by commissions, there are plenty of internal breaks within the system that are going to prevent that from happening.
Justice C.
There were a number of comments that came down here. Let me say, I have no problem with those federal commissions. What I'm talking about is accountability. And if the president wants to set up some sort of a commission, or a governor wants to set up some sort of a commission, or senators want to set up some sort of a commission to guide them, that's fine. The point is, with our federal judiciary, the president is still held accountable. And I think we see that in this last election. That was one of the issues on which people voted. So my concern is that there's accountability. There's a difference between a commission set up by senators or by a governor and a commission that is independent of and, in fact, dictates to the governor who he may choose. Ask yourself when you go to the poll, do you know who these judges are? Or go out on the street and stop the 10 people and ask them if they can name their Supreme Court justices. And the answer is typically no. We did a poll in Alabama a couple of years ago, and something like 80% of the people couldn't name their U.S. senators. I'll stop you and ask you who your school board representative is, or probably your state legislator. If that is what is necessary for popular government to work, then all this is meaningless. But I think that's a grave misperception of the way popular government is intended to work. I think the way it's intended to work is that voters want a check if there's a problem. I mean, we talk about it every election. Incumbents keep getting reelected. Yeah, because folks are happy with them. There's no reason not to. But you get someone unhappy, you show them the problem, and you give them an alternative, they'll know who to vote for, they'll know who to vote against. Ask a whole lot of folks who aren't here this year. You know, when there is an issue and the people are concerned, then they do something about it. They knew who to vote for in those elections that Ms. Chertoff referred to, in those state elections where there was a contest, and they voted for the incumbents overwhelmingly in the races that weren't highly contested. There's the point that running for election, this expensive election stuff discourages people from running for election. Yeah. And look at what goes on in the appointment process, and that discourages people from seeking appointments. I mean, these are problems. They're real problems, but they aren't problems that go away just because you hide them. Do we think that when a name comes out and bad things are said about him in an appointment process, Clarence Thomas and people, do we think those things wouldn't get said before a commission? That they wouldn't have as devastating an impact on selection of a judge? But the difference would be there'd be no chance to respond. At least in an election, you have a chance to respond and say, hey, that's not me. I didn't do that. That's not the way the way I believe. I was interested for my sake, I never, when I was talking about judicial activism and judicial conservatism, I didn't use the words Democrats or Republicans. I don't know why he took it to refer to Democrats. Yeah, it can be both. The question is not whether you're conservative or liberal. The question is, do you believe that you ought to strive your best to apply the law is written, or do you believe that you have latitude to modify it based on what you believe is best policy? Let's see. I guess the other point would, and it's a minor point, is the retention elections. The way that's normally sold is to point out that I think in Supreme Court cases we have three in the whole history of merit selection that have been defeated in a retention election, and the reason for that's obvious. Also, there's no opponent. And we just talked about what elections are about. It's about information. It's about finding out whether there's some reason to change who you've got in office. And if there's no opponent, there's no incentive to generate information to show you what the problem is with a particular judge. And therefore, we would have no reason to expect that person to be defeated. Now, the danger in it is, of course, that if someone is upset with a judge and waits until the last minute and puts together a lot of money, the judge has no way to defend himself. So I've got problems on both sides of retention election.
All right. I'd like to pick up on this idea of judicial independence versus accountability, because obviously one is going to be subordinate to the other depending upon which selection method is chosen. And the critics of judicial election very often decry elections as a threat to judicial independence, and that's Justice O'Connor's rallying cry on this cause that she has taken up since leaving the Supreme Court. And I know that's very hard to test for empirically. You're a scholar in this area. If you would share with us some of the concerns of those who raise that as the real problem with judicial elections.
This is a difficult thing to assess, and the phrase independence itself is a controversial phrase. When they poll on that, people don't like the notion of independence. What they like is the notion of fair and impartial courts, where everybody gets a fair shake. And to that extent, we have found that election of judges, there is an intimidation factor that does exist where judges can tailor their opinions based on the prevailing political winds. In an environment such as the one that we're coming into, that can be problematic for conservative, strict constructionist judges. In a different political environment, it may be more problematic for judges who have more pronounced political and social agendas. So when we look at, you know, what is it that we're looking for in good judges, it's been one of the hardest questions that we've asked, because one of the things that we have been trying to do is to help set up what might be some good objective criteria that can be used in voter guides. And we look at things like experience, education, what role that the proposed judges have played in their community. And so we're looking for indicia not of particular positions that people are going to take, but really questions that go to temperament. And that goes across party lines. You know, we're really not looking to result oriented, but we're looking at temperament issues. And yes, I think that may result sometimes in boring judges. But I don't know that we want our judges to always be scintillating and peppery. I mean, a little scattering of those is probably a good thing. You know, it keeps the rest of the bench awake. But I think that in general what we want is a thoughtful temperament that decides cases based upon the law. And in getting those, you're not necessarily going to be looking at where people come out, but on who they are.
Why shouldn't judges, or the people, I should say, the public at the ballot box have a say over the philosophical composition of the public's courts?
Well, again, that's a question of whether it's a direct election or whether it's done through these nominating commissions. The people do have a say. They have a say when it comes to the retention elections. But I want to say a word about education, because Judge Thee and I do agree on one thing. He raised earlier that maybe what the ABA and the bar associations ought to be doing is talking more about education. And one of our big concerns at the O'Connor Project is education. Education of the voters, but even more education of young people. And I'm sure that you have heard this mantra before, but one of the biggest problems that we have seen is how little young people understand about what judges do and how little they understand, you know, I mean, I can cite, you know, most young people can't name three Supreme Court justices. They don't know who the chief is. You know, they don't know. They say that the president can override the decision of the Supreme Court if he doesn't agree with it. So these are all indicia of real ignorance on the part of our young people. And one of the things that Justice O'Connor has done as part of our project is set up something called the Our Courts Project. And we are developing an interactive online program which will be accessible to middle school students to teach them about the civics through the lens of the courts. And we're hoping that by having a more educated electorate, a more educated next generation, that judicial elections will work better because people will know what they should be thinking about when they elect judges.
We can judicial elections themselves serve an educational function in teaching the public through the course of the campaign about the role of the courts?
Well, I think they do. Now, granted, I'd like them to serve more of that function, and I think we can't rely on campaigns alone. But when I have traveled around campaigning, I've made the point, look, you shouldn't vote for me because you like my decision, or you shouldn't vote against me because you don't like my decision. You should vote for me if you believe I'm following the law. You should vote against me, even if you like the decision, if you think I'm not. That's the way a judge is supposed to be evaluated. I think there's a general understanding that among the voting public. As they understand, judges may decide cases in ways that they don't particularly like, and I don't think they hold that against those judges as a general proposition. But if they do, then I think the answer is not taking the franchise away. The answer is to give that sort of public education. Could I make a comment on the independent? Because you know, we throw out the word independent, and then we say that means the judge should be independent of any accountability. Now, generally, the response would be, oh, no, he should be accountable to the law. Okay, well, who's going to hold the judge accountable to the law? When we're talking about judicial independence, we're talking about independence from the other two branches of government. The judges should be free from control by, in general, aside from the checks and balances, by the legislature, the executive. They ought not be the tool of those two branches. That's the independence we're talking about. And you get more independence if you have public support than you do if you don't. If you're completely at the whim of the legislature, then how independent can you possibly be? So, yeah, I believe in independent judiciary. I believe in a judiciary that's strong enough to stand up against challenges by the legislative and by the executive. And I believe judges should be required to be fair and impartial. And I believe the public should hold them accountable to make sure that they are.
What about the very practical political concern that it's very difficult to run for a statewide elective office to a state Supreme Court or even to an intermediate court of appeals or a state trial court seat by emphasizing your qualifications alone? I'm well educated, I'm capable, I'm experienced, and I will neutrally apply the law, vote for me. I mean, you and I have both faced the voters in a statewide election. And they want more than that.
And that's the campaign. Well, who wants more than that? I mean,
You and I have been around on the rubber chicken circuit and Friday night fish fry.
And they want to know us, right? I mean, they want to know us, and that's what the campaigning is all about. And you go out and they get some idea of who you are and what type of a person you are. And beyond that, then the record. You know, what sort of a record that you have, and that gets brought up, and that's permissible to bring up. But you know, that's whoever is going to make that decision is going to want that information. That is a problem that you have in appointments too. I mean, that's what the Senate is fighting about right now, right? How much can you ask? The senators would like to know more. I mean, yeah, okay. Yeah, but you still have to be a judge. You have to be committed to doing a judge's job.
Can I jump in here?
Please.
I guess I have a question for you, Judge C., which is that these ads in Alabama, do you think that they were good educational ads? Cobb race? I mean, these were dreadful ads, and I don't think that they did much in terms of educating the public about what the real issues and personalities were of those candidates.
Well, yes and no. I mean, would I have loved to have seen nice, sweet ads? Yeah, I suppose so. I think a fair amount of what went into each ad wasn't particularly educational. But to say that these campaigns were not the way I would have them in an ideal world doesn't make merit selection somehow preferable.
Well, the problem is we still have the First Amendment. So as long as we have these ads, that's the way the campaign is going to be this race These are how the campaigns will be run. It's just going to get worse and worse.
No. What you will find if you look at that is when people who get a little too carried away find that they are losing, they then start running that kind of ad. Typically, that is the losing candidate. Not always. I've seen a couple of exceptions, but in general, the one who runs those ads is the one who loses. And that says to me the public has pretty good judgment.
All right, let's bring it back over to this side of the podium. We've seen an escalation in the propaganda wars and federal judicial selection as well, whether it's on the air or on the floor of the Senate Judiciary Committee in a hearing. And I wonder if you would address yourselves to the escalating rhetoric in the federal system. Really started with Judge Bork.
Yes, it did. Well, I hesitate to acknowledge that it started with Judge Bork because I don't know all the facts. I think we have a long history, and lots of Supreme Court nominees prior to Judge Bork failed to be confirmed. And I just don't know what the rhetoric was in historically. But obviously, in modern times, we saw a great escalation with Judge Bork, and in my view, it was disgraceful and very effective. And we saw the same. More so with the nomination process that Justice Thomas. Having said all that, I actually don't think that the rhetoric of the style of argument and the tone and the kinds of arguments that have been made during this administration have been really out of bounds. Maybe some. I think in Justice Alito's confirmation hearing, some lines were crossed that oughtn't to have been. But my own view is that, generally speaking, at the senatorial level, not interest group level, at the senatorial level, the rhetoric was generally okay. The problem is that, of course, interest groups are very influential in this process, and the more that you treat judicial confirmations in the Senate as a political campaign, the more of that which is to be expected, and that just it feeds on itself, not necessarily in public rhetoric, but in behind closed doors kinds of tactics. One final thing I'll say about that is that it's very important at the Supreme Court level, hugely important at the Supreme Court level, to get a good rollout. If you are running a nomination, it's very important that the media and public reception in the very beginning days be good. And it's a lesson that won't be lost on the Obama administration, that everybody involved knew that the Chief Justice would be confirmed. There'd be bumps along the road within days because the rollout and his reception and the media treatment and everything about how it happened was so terrific from our perspective. That it was very hard for the interest groups to get traction against him. There's no question that the interest groups are going to be against or for the nomination no matter what. And the real challenge for the interest groups and on both sides is to get media and public traction on whatever sort of issue that you want to raise. In the nomination of Justice Alito, the silly, trivial, nonsensical Vanguard issue involving his sitting on an unargued case involving a mutual fund, was all of those things. It was silly and trivial and ridiculous. The judge said, oh, gosh, I don't have to, but we're going to redo the case with a different panel and get the same outcome, which I'm not involved in. In the vetting process, we hardly even thought about that. Obviously, it's not an issue. But it started to get a little traction, and it became dangerous to the nomination. So the rhetoric point is not necessarily the level or fieriness of it. It is what you can do to get traction one way or another.
I can't disagree with anything that Bill just said. I think that's right. The rollout is critical. The rollout on Harriet Myers was not as successful at the beginning, particularly with respect to conservatives as opposed to moderates on that issue. And I think that's one of the reasons why her nomination didn't succeed. Yes, we've had periods in history before where people have been posed on political grounds. I think George Washington had one of his Supreme Court nominees go down because he was opposed to the Jay Treaty, and that generated some political response at that particular point. But I think that Bill's exactly right on his overall appraisal.
All right, one final question on the politics. politics of recusal before we throw it open to questions. And Professor Kelly's last comment raises this, at least insofar as elected judges are concerned. We've seen an increase in the calls for recusal of elected judges from cases on the basis of campaign contributions. Professor Chertoff mentioned the Supreme Court case that will be heard this term on that issue. That involved a phenomenal contribution of $1.5 million, something like that, which is, it's unusual that you would see a contribution of that magnitude in a state court election. Usually it's something far less, or it's a call for recusal based upon special interest spending over which the candidate has no control and, in fact, is legally prohibited from coordinating with special interests. And in my own state, we've seen this happen, and I know in other states as well. There is a sideshow created when cases come before the court, which threatens to, at least in my judgment, politicize the judging process. And I don't know, Justice C, if you've given any thought or care to comment on that.
I think it's a problem. There are problems with every system that you have, and I do think there is this perception problem, and it could be a real problem depending on the situation. I mean, generally, the comment was made, I think, anyway, one of the two made the comment about can't imagine why someone would run for office and, you know, have to raise all that money and get low pay and so on. And the fact of the matter is, you know, those contributions don't have anything that don't go to the judge. They go to the campaign. And if the judge is successful, he then makes less money than he did when he was in private practice. So as a practical matter, that is probably not going to have any influence. Nonetheless, you know, there may be exceptional situations, and this West Virginia case sounds exceptional, or there may be there may be other facts involved, and so, you know, recusal is certainly an issue, certainly a question. Now, you can't say, though, that just because someone has contributed to a judge, that therefore the judge must recuse in all those cases where that one person, lawyer or litigant, is involved, or you've gutted the process. You have no way to get information out. It is costly to get information out. I calculated one time if I could get all the citizens of all the voters of Alabama to line up and I'd shake hands with them, and if I could do that, I don't remember, you know, one every 2 seconds or something, how many years it would take me to do it. You cannot reach out and talk to all the voters in a statewide race. The only way you can do it is through some sort of advertising. Advertising costs money, and that means there have to be campaign contributions. Now, we isolate judges somewhat from that. We say, you shouldn't be out raising money yourself. You got a committee. The committee raises money. And you keep your hands off of it, but there's a perception problem, and I think that perception problem has to be dealt with. I would prefer dealing with perception problems than hiding problems. If there is a problem, I think it ought to be out in the open. I don't think we ought to hide it. And that's what bothers me about these commissions, where you know the same interests are doing the same things to capture the commissions, to get their judges there. I mean, if you believe that people are trying to get judges elected, you have to believe they would try to get those same judges appointed. And to hide it where people can't see it, where there isn't open reporting, as there is with elections, you know. We know. Why do we know about this case in West Virginia? Because he ran for election, and you can see the reports, and it's there. If he'd been appointed, that all of that investment would have been hidden, and we wouldn't know, and we couldn't clean it up.
Professor Chertoff.
Well, it seems to me that if people are making direct donations to people sitting on commissions, that the criminal laws would have something to say about that.
But that's not how they do it in the commissions in Washington, D.C., is it?
Well, yeah. But, I mean, a direct, you know, that's a bribe if you give a direct donation to somebody who's supposed to be acting in an official capacity.
I'm not talking about bribes.
Right.
But
having said that, look, you're not going to be able to have recusal every time a judge takes campaign contribution, as long as the system is set up in that way, recusal has to be limited to large to large donors. On the other hand, the peril is on the other side. It's anecdotally been observed and reported that if you come in and you come into the state of Texas to litigate a case, you need to retain outside. You need to retain Texas counsel, and the Texas counsel you retain had better be somebody who's made a donation to the judge who's sitting on the case in the last election. And so, I mean, that is a source of concern because, you know, it may be that the campaign contributions go to the committee, but you can be pretty well sure that the judge knows who's given to their campaigns. Everybody knows who gives to their campaigns. I mean, the judges see the same election reports that everybody else does, and you know who has been a friend of your campaign. Can the judges continue to be fair and impartial? I think that in most cases, judges will be fair and impartial in any given case, but at the margins, they cannot help but be influenced by the fact that there are people who are their friends, and that is a problem for the system, not necessarily in terms of actual bias, but in terms of the people looking at it and saying, well, how can these judges possibly be fair? They've gotten, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars from the trialers, or they've gotten, you know, millions of dollars from the oil industry. And how can the judges be fair? And that's a problem for the system. And that's why an enhanced, invigorated system of recusal, not necessarily recusal in every case where there's been a donation, but where they are substantial donations, seems like a very appropriate way to at least head off some of the worst excesses.
Yeah, I'm not sure we disagree that much. Clearly there are situations where recusal would be necessary. Clearly we cannot require recusal in every case if we're going to fund elections. And I agree there is a problem of perception, and I think that problem needs to be dealt with. I would use a little stronger word on with respect to judges being able to be fair in these situations, because a judge, why do you become a judge? I can think of almost no one, maybe a couple, who couldn't make it as lawyers and wanted to be judges. You know, but generally, you could do a whole lot better if you weren't a judge financially. So the fact that someone's giving you money to run for a judge, I mean that's nice, but you're running for judge for another reason. You believe something about being a judge. There's something that you're committed to, and you're willing to make a sacrifice to do that. And the idea that it would be at all common for people to sell that out for a campaign contribution strikes me as absurd.
Right, we're now ready to take your questions. And there's one here in the center. There's a microphone over on the side. I don't know if there's one over there as well. Looks like just the two. If you'd like to line up, and why don't we start here?
My name is Ronnie Sams, and I'm from the great state of Texas, where Davy Crockett died at the Alamo, giving us freedom in March of 1836.
Yeah, okay.
Wonderful, wonderful man. Yeah. What role, in terms of election of judges, we as attorneys look to stare decisis or precedent for our law many times. What role does precedent play in the election of state court judges, where in the great state of Texas we have a precedent of electing judges from the last constitution that we enacted nearly 130 years ago? I think that precedent ought to have something to do with whether we elect judges or whether we have commissions. What role does precedent play in this?
If we get real practical, I think each state. Let me back up a little bit. I indicated I have no problem with appointment. I have no problem with election. It's a merit selection problem. It's anything I have a problem with. But I think different states may find different systems more suitable to them. And so I think, yeah, the experience of the state makes a lot of difference. I know in Alabama, I think it's 80-some percent of the public says we want to elect our judges. That's not going to change. I suspect Texas is the same way.
I think it's the case that from everything we've seen people don't want, people from elected judges state don't want to give up those elections because that's something that they're accustomed to. We would argue for certain other kinds of reforms that would again, take the temperature down a little bit, including more transparency in campaign contributions, improved voter guides, nonpartisan elections as opposed to partisan elections, which is a reform which is a less of a significant reform. I think the judges themselves in Texas, the ones that I have spoken with, find that unending pressure to dial for dollars to be a great burden on them. And the ones that I've spoken to find it extremely painful to have to do that. Now, you know, that may be a Texas tradition, but it's certainly not one which encourages the judges to keep running for office. Perhaps the fact that Texas has such a strong judiciary state and the role of the judge is politically as powerful, maybe an incentive on the other side to keep running. But I know that they're not too happy about that constant pressure to run.
All right, so the room.
Yes, Pepper Crutcher from Mississippi, where sadly campaign contributions are different from bribes only as a matter of taste. It occurs to me that we're talking a lot about selection. Election appointment when we ought to be talking about re-election, because that's the problem of corruption. Why aren't we talking about the importance of life tenure during good behavior without reduction of compensation? Isn't that a solution to a lot of what's wrong with our elections?
I think so. Yeah, I'm in favor of a single term. I mean, it can if you want to do it a life term. I think there's a problem of accountability when it gets to be too long. But say a single term, 18 years. 15 years, I don't know, pick your date, and I think that solves a lot of those problems, yeah.
Well, I find myself in agreement with Judge C. here. You know, we're perfectly happy with appointed judges. It creates its own, as I said, its own set of problems because there is an invisible hand there, but there's nothing that we find necessarily objectionable about it. That's the federal system, and that's served us well in this country for our history.
Any reaction to that over here? Nope. All right, go ahead.
Hi, Fred Ansell, I'm local. Professor Chertoff, what are the arguments that you've raised for opposing judicial elections? Is that judges will decide cases differently because of the fear of the electorate? My question to you is, given the history in this country of elected officials who get books written about them because of their political courage, why should anyone feel any sympathy for any judge who will not follow the law that they believe is required because they fear losing the election, that somehow them being a judge is more important to them than deciding the case according to the facts and the law? Why should anyone oppose judicial elections on that ground?
Well, you're asking a good question. We hope that our judges will act without fear and favor. We want to select judges who will do that. On the other hand, judges, like anybody else, are human, and they are subject to feeling pressure in the same way that legislators may feel pressure to occasionally tailor the decisions that they make to be reelected, even if they feel that the right thing to do in a situation may be different than the political pressure. And the system is set up so that legislators should respond to those popular pressures. But for judges, we are hoping that they'll be able to take a longer view. I mean, everybody is a minority at some time. And the role of the judges is envisioned in our federal constitutional system is for the judges, at least in part, to protect the rights of individuals. And so we would hope that the judges would do that at the state, in the state level as well. But if they are pressured with having to respond every 2 or 4 years to election campaigns which are based on prevailing political winds, they're not going to be able to take that longer view. I mean, we hope that they will be responsive to the public's will, but the political will over a long-term basis and not short-term political currents.
May I rephrase your question just a little bit? Isn't it true that if someone has so little backbone, he will not stand up for the law when he's sworn his oath to do so, that when he goes to the club and his friends start questioning what he did, that he will lack the same backbone. So should we change our institution of selecting judges in order to try to protect him from one of the many pressures from family and friends and newspapers and so on, when we know he's going to cave anyway? I'd say no.
Yeah, except that what you're going to, I mean, the problem is that if you have the judge who has backbone and gets voted out, the people who are going to come in are the ones without the backbone. I mean, that's part of the issue. That's what's created by this dynamic.
Well,
is if voting to acquit, if ruling that a particular conviction should be thrown out or a death penalty overturned, leads to somebody's not being reelected, that we would hope that the judge will do what he or she would have done anyway. But if they do that and then get voted out, the person who's going to replace them is somebody who probably doesn't have that backbone.
But that rarely happens. And the one classic example in Alabama is the judge who ordered the retrial of the Scottsboro boys got voted out. And he is someone who, when I give an address to a graduating class, I evoke. And he's an example to countless generations of law students as the way they are supposed to behave.
Whether we should have sympathy for a judge who succumbs to that temptation, because we oughtn't to. I mean, people take an oath and they ought to do their job according to the oath. But it's much more of a structural question than that. And I think of Madison, and the central insight of the structure of our Constitution is that you need to set up institutions so that ambition can be made to counteract ambition, the interests of the man can be aligned with the interests of the office, et cetera, so that we have to consider whether we set up our institutions to provide the correct personal incentives to do the job right. And the founders, and particularly Madison, understood that people have lives and families and need to make a living, for heaven's sake. Think about how frequently and directly and explicitly the Constitution addresses questions of pay. And it's because human nature is such that it's always tempting to put your own personal livelihood ahead of duty. And the Constitution is designed, obviously, and we all know this, to minimize that incentive structure so that it can work constructively rather than destructively. So in the judicial context, it's a policy choice. That's all it is. It's a policy choice, whether you want to have or not have those sorts of living-based incentives in your judges. The Constitution makes the choice for us at the federal level, and it's just a policy choice otherwise at the state level.
We're supposed to be.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're supposed to be over there. Sorry. Go ahead.
Kurt Levy, Committee for Justice. Justice C laid out sort of the two visions of the law, one as a judge, more as an umpire, and the other as a judge who does what's right. And, you know, I suppose you can argue both are equally genuine, good faith views of what a judge should do. But they're not symmetric in one sense. It's the latter view which gives judges greater power. If you can determine what's right, you can determine, who's right, you can determine, you know, what is right and wrong, which is basically unlimited power. And I think everyone on the panel agrees that the more power you give judges, the more you politicize the process. So the obvious conclusion is if you want to depoliticize it, put some limits on the power of judges. Well, I'm pretty sure that those who believe in the judge who does right view are not going to renounce that in order to depoliticize the process, nor is that very enforceable. You could think of, legislative or constitutional fixes to limit the power of judges, such as jurisdictional limits or ways to make them accountable. I suppose recall elections are one. Override by a legislative supermajority is another. Those have their imperfections. But in the end, it does come down, as Professor Kelly was just talking about, incentives. If it's worth $3 million to put the right person on the court, that $3 million is going to be expressed in one way or the other. The ultimate goal is to make it worth only $100,000 to put someone on the court so that it doesn't get so politicized. But again, given that there's no obvious way to limit the power of a judge, you know, isn't this hopeless? Isn't it going to remain as politicized as it is from now to the foreseeable future?
Well, is it hopeless?
We need to rebuild the culture. I mean, I think we need to have conservatives criticize decisions with conservative results as being lawless when they are, and there are a number of those. We need to have liberals criticize liberal decisions or those that come out when those are lawless. And if we're doing it right, we can maybe recreate the kind of thing. I really don't believe, and I don't know too many who believe that judges at the appellate level should just be able to do the right thing as they see it. They're supposed to follow the law. We can have honest disagreements about what that means. But I think that's clearly right. And I think in order to be able to promote our own integrity, we need to be able to, and the integrity of the process, those of us who are observers need to make the fair count. I've given the same speech to both Federal Society groups and ACS. I think Lawrence versus Texas and Carhart versus Gonzalez are the same case. It's just one person telling us what they believe the morality of an issue is. There's no content in either case. And I think we need to have people speak out when a decision is favorable to them, because their credibility is a lot higher when it looks like it's supporting your result than your political result than it is on the other side. And we need to recreate an honesty rather than seeing ourselves as on opposing teams that can never admit that our side has done something incorrect. But we need to do that as part of this bringing forward a greater sense of balance and a greater source of fealty to a principle of law rather than just furthering our own political agendas.
I think it's clearly right that it is a legal culture matter, and it is so important that the legal culture be legal instead of political. There's no question about that. The problem I have is that it's not that people go around saying that the law is good policy outcomes from a liberal perspective. That's not so much the objection. The objection is when you have people like my friend Jeff Sutton, who is attacked because of the policy outcomes of cases in which he's representing clients and legal questions that he won, for heaven's sake. And that makes him somehow illegitimate, not because of his legal reasoning. He won the cases, multiple. It's because they didn't like the policy outcome of those cases and thought and deemed it illegitimate to have made legal arguments in favor of those. And I think at the political level, and I hope the Republicans don't engage in the same behavior, because at the political level in the Senate, we have to distinguish between reasoning and outcome. I always tell my students that a judge can't call himself a judge until he makes a decision that makes him want to vomit, right? Because you have to be willing to make decisions you don't like if you're a judge. It's the very definition that there's something external to the judge. We all know this, obviously. But when the political culture collapses that distinction, that has been the road to ruin for us.
Go ahead.
Stephanie Webb from Morehead State University in Kentucky. My question is for Professor Marshall. Would you please expand on the qualifications that you mentioned earlier for bipartisan judicial selection?
What do you mean? Expand on that.
What types of qualifications would you recommend?
I think we ought to take a look at somebody's, obviously, if they take a look at their judicial temperament. We should take a look at their accomplishment, what they've done throughout their legal career. We should take a look, I think, at how they're perceived by those in their communities in terms of their legal reputation, their reputation for fairness. Those are the kinds of things that I think that we need to take a look at. Those are the kinds of qualifications that I think need to guide us. We ought to have very intelligent, very, very able judges appointed to the federal bench. Those are the kinds of things that we need to do.
What about legal philosophy?
No, the legal philosophy question, I'm troubled by I don't quite know how to do it. I mean, if you read Justice Scalia's opinion in White, when he says we got to accept the fact that people's legal philosophies will guide their decisions. If we say that that's true, and sometimes I think it's unconscious the way that happens, is there some sort of general inquiry that can take place into that? Probably.
But I think it should be limited. I think that it's been overdone in part in the last 8 years by some. I think that, but there's some of it that I think that is out there that needs to do it. I mean, the problem is saying that you're a strict constructionist doesn't say very much. Strict constructionists seem to come to different results on different kinds of issues. So a little bit, but I think we have to be careful on that. And I agree that certainly one of the things you don't look at is what position somebody took as an advocate and say that somehow disqualifies them for a particular particular position. Unfortunately, there's a temptation for people on the other side opposing a nomination to do that, because everybody in this world of sound bites, everybody's looking for a quick sound bite. Put somebody on the defensive, you've won half the battle.
That we may want to think about is we want to allow judges to grow in their roles, and we want them to be able to develop their own judicial philosophy. And one of the problems with a revolving door type of election system is that it's not going to allow the judges to grow and to develop their own judicial philosophies.
Justice C, any comment on that?
No.
Okay. Next.
Marshall. My question is about, you said that the unprecedented filibusters during the last 8 years were due in part to Orrin Hatch's blue slip policy. How do you explain the fact that the first ever circuit court nominee filibustered, Miguel Estrada, was from D.C. where there were no blue slips?
Well, I didn't say that was the only reason that, and if you took my statement of saying that was the only reason, no, that was the reason why the Michigan appointees were filibustered was the objection to the blue slip policy. Yeah, the objection to Estrada did not involve the lack of blue slips. That one involved the question of whether or not certain documents about Miguel Estrada's background were being made available to the Judiciary Committee. You're smiling because you're saying that was, I mean, I gather you think that, you know, that was the argument that was being presented at the time. Was that kind of filibuster?
Did the Republicans do the same kind of thing?
No, they just simply didn't let people get hearings at all. So Elena Kagan, you know, Harvard should send a thank you note to Orrin Hatch, but Elena Kagan never got a hearing. Helene White was held up for 4 years. The difference there was just, you know, there were no hearings given. And we can go back and forth. A lot of, you know, one of the things that that Bill said, and he's absolutely right, you know, when I left Washington, you know, the question comes, which side flies the flag of surrender first? Which side gives in to try to improve the process? And it's a difficult question when you see that your side was wronged. In the case of the Clinton administration, there were a lot of people left on the table who never got hearings, some for as long as 4 years. Some people of incredible qualification like Elena Kagan. The question is, do you turn those slots over automatically, or do you engage in a searching kind of inquiry for yourself? And if you do that and then start employing more and more kinds of tactics on your side, can you expect that the other side will do that? You certainly can. Then can you expect in the next administration, when it's reversed, both sides are going to use the tactics that they roundly condemned when they were on the other side of it? The answer is yeah. But I think we need to sort of we need to break the cycle at some point.
And last question.
John Carpe with the Canadian Constitution Foundation. We are about, in Canada, we're about 26 years into our experiment with a charter that is similar to your Bill of Rights. Prior to that, we had a system of parliamentary sovereignty where Parliament was supreme and didn't have judges with the power to strike down legislation as unconstitutional. We've had debates as well when courts come down with decisions that outrage conservatives, the people on the left will say, well, no, that's not a policy decision, that's just the rule of law, they're just applying the law. But then conversely, on the rare occasion where a decision comes out that outrages the left, you'll hear the conservatives saying, well, that's not a policy decision, that's just the rule of law. And what we often hear is that judges saying, well, our personal philosophy doesn't matter because we're deciding cases according to law, which to me seems a bit circular because the judge is deciding what the law is. So it's appealing to an authority when you're actually also making up the content of that authority. So I invite comment from the panelists on that last point. Can you really say honestly that a judge is not influenced by personal philosophy or guided by it, and is just ruling according to law, when the judge is also deciding what the content of that law is to which he or she is appealing as authority?
Okay, a philosophical question. How much discretion do judges have to decide what the law is? Professor Chertoff said very little initially, but maybe she'd like to address herself to that.
Well, I think it depends on what level you're talking about. Certainly at the trial court level, the discretion is extremely limited. As you work your way up, there's more and more of it. But even when you work your way up to the highest levels, most decisions, the judges, even at the appellate level, find themselves bound by precedent. And it's really only at the margin that their personal experience plays into it at all. And I think that, the good judge tries to look at the law and to follow the law to the extent that they can do it. I don't think there's any disagreement about that here. But I do agree with what some of the prior commentators talked about, is we want to create an incentive system which allows the judges to be faithful to the law to the extent possible and not to have outside influences affect the prism through which they're going to view that law.
Justice Singh. Yeah,
that's really sort of the question about whether the universe is continuous or discrete. Of course, there is margin there. I mean, we're human beings, and we're fallible human beings. I think the real question is, what is it that the judge should be seeking to do? And there is something in that language that they're interpreting. There is some substance in that language. There's also some ambiguity in the language. I find it extraordinarily difficult to try to do what the language is, you know, try to figure out and do what the language is telling me to do, and to invite me to go beyond that and somehow, you know, create something else would be very disconcerting. But recognizing that, yeah, you've got the deal. The legislature may pass two acts, and you may find some conflict between them. You have to figure out, well, they meant this here, they meant that there, but how does that fit together? So yeah, we have a creative process we're involved in that we must strive not to be creative. You know, our goal should be to do exactly what we're told to do so far as it is possible to do that. Once we say, well, look, there's going to be a little flex in here anyway, therefore we're free to do whatever we want, that's disaster. That's not the rule of law. That's not the role of a judge.
Any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that it's impossible. I think the judge sees right. It's impossible to get it out of the way, but I think the problem with this panel really is addressed is how do you create the aspiration to not let politics influence your decision all that much. And the conclusion I get is you need to depoliticize the system. And that's why I think I disagree with you on the election of judges, because I think that increases the politicization of it. But a judge who is given the position after they go through a very political hearing sees license to do what they want to do. A judge who is subject to a political culture that says that in order to be a good judge, you have to get beyond what may be these innate personal feelings, I think, might come to different decisions.
Professor Kelly?
Very briefly, the whole system depends on what you say not being true. And it's not that people can deny that the views of a judge have influence on decisions. The question is one of methodology, interpretive methodology, and why you're making the decision. If you're making the decision to reach the outcome for that purpose, that's completely illegitimate. If your interpretive methodologies and your good faith attempt to apply the legal materials in front of you lead you to an outcome, that's a very different thing. And finally, I'll just say that the whole system, again, depends on judges applying materials external to themselves. Because if it's not that,
then it's just politics. And if it's just politics, we have the right to govern ourselves, not to be governed by them.
With that, let's thank our panel.